Good morning. My name is Shija, and I come from University of Florida. I would like to, at this point, acknowledge my co-authors, Dr. Sipal and Dr. David Wright. Dr. Sipal had a couple presentations at this meeting. In fact, one of them is going on right now concurrently with this session, and he had another one on Monday. I wonder if any of you were able to attend that. But a lot of work, all the technical presentations about this crop were presented during his talks. This morning, I would like to just present to you this crop as another option, not necessarily discuss the details of producing Brassica carinata, but necessarily discuss the possibilities that Brassica carinata presents in the Southeast. I also would like to acknowledge people that we work with, our collaborators. AgriSoma is a Canadian biotechnology company that holds the world's largest germplasm for Brassica carinata. In fact, they are the sole holders of Brassica carinata. Applied Research Associates is the chemical engineering company out of Panama City, Florida, that works, that is the fuel producers. They have a patented conversion and a licensed pathway for the fuel production. Florida Department of Ag that funded a lot of our work so far. With that, the common thinking was that before 2007 was, if it was a biofuel, it was good. As long as it only needed to be bio, and it was good. And then later on, the thinking transformed to, well, it needs to be a non-food. Whereas now we are at a point where, well, the devil is in the details. You just cannot assume that as long as you're growing a food crop for fuel, it's all good. The irony of the situation is that there's a need for everybody in this room. We do not need to go over all of that again, but there's need for energy and food security. U.S. transportation contributes about 27% of the total emissions, whereas it contributes about 30% of global transportation greenhouse gas emissions. These are numbers. We are probably in the ballpark. It differs here and there. We also know that there's a renewable fuel standards. It's currently an RFS 2 that's going on that requires about 36 billion gallons of renewable fuel by 2022, which is not far away anymore. It's looming over us, mostly coming from advanced cellulosic biofuels and not from first-generation fuels. The greenhouse gas reduction thresholds are higher. The mandate to reduce greenhouse gases is much higher than it was. And more food and more fuel comes at an environmental cost. The irony that I was talking about is you have transportation as a big emitter, big source of greenhouse gas emissions, and then now we turn to agriculture to counter those emissions, but here we have agriculture as another big emitter of greenhouse gases. So it is an irony, but it also presents exciting opportunity to kind of walk this tightrope, walk this fine balance. This curve talks about how by the year 2022, conventional biofuels are like, they're not increasing at all, and how the advanced biofuels are soon overtaking between now and 2022. Everybody in this room has their favorite feedstock that they work with. Depending on where you are, you know what the mandate is by 2022 and beyond. We don't stop at 2022. It's very complicated, like Dr. Jarada just presented. Do we have a model for low carbon? We don't. But just putting tangible, common sense metrics or common sense reasons for why we should move away from non-food crops for bioenergy is there's land displaced somewhere to grow biofuel crops. There's a commodity shortfall resulting in increased prices. So somewhere, you to make up for that shortfall, you have to convert land somewhere. And then that results in release in sequestered carbon. For instance, a forest, a nice pristine forest where carbon was sequestered has to be cleared. And then that offsets all the reduced greenhouse gases that you imagine would happen by converting to biofuels. Just simple. It's not as simple as that. It's much more complicated than that. So what are the options we have? We turn to the several options of biomass that we have to convert to liquid fuel alternatives instead of the food sugars and the food starches and the food oil seeds, like your edible rape seeds and things like that that we used in the past. Where do we grow them? We grow them on marginal land and underutilized land, provided the economics of growing them are viable. It's not always the case. Like I said, the devil is in the details. We cannot just assume things can happen. It sounds ideal, but it's not always the case. There is a demand. We need to grow. Again, I referred to Dr. Jaradat's presentation. There is a demand. Just if you look at only aviation demand in the U.S., about 90 million acres could grow just lipid-based feedstock and about 480 million acres for energy crops in general. There is demand. And that's where the double cropping potential kicks in. The title that I sent Dr. Tour earlier was Brassica carinata as a non-food drop-in cover crop. And then NRCS came to us and said, no, you cannot call it a cover crop, because I don't know what the definition of a cover crop in other parts of the U.S. are, but in the Southeast, you cannot harvest anything. If you're harvesting it, it's not a cover crop. Even if I'm returning all the residues to the ground, I'm only going away with the seed, I still cannot technically call it a cover crop. And so I had to take it out of my title now doesn't have cover crop in it. So we call it double crop. Whatever you call it, I'm covering my land in the winter. So those are technicalities. But I cannot call it a cover crop, and correct me if I ever use that. We're all singing the same song. We're all speaking the same language. There's need for crop diversification and an urgent need. Whether you're talking biofuels or you're talking just normal growing food crops, there's urgent need for crop diversification, for the farmer to economically diversify. There is an environmental cost if there is fallowed cropland. And then, last but definitely not the least, the benefits of building soil health with year-round cover. The Southeast, moving focus to the Southeast, which is what I represent, leads the nation in total double cropped acreage. If you look, it's about 4.5 million acres double cropped, but the potential is far more. There's about 12 million acres or so in the Southeast that has potential to be cropped in the winter. We're sitting with 60 inches or more of rainfall. I mean, where else would you grow two crops easily without a problem? But it's not done. I mean, less than half of that potential is tapped so far. With that introduction, I want to introduce Brassica carinata. As the name indicates, it's the Brassica species, also known as the Ethiopian mustard, originated in Ethiopia, a very, very drought-tolerant, shatter-resistant Brassica. What makes it a non-food, it's a close relative of the canola. But what makes it a non-food is because it has a long-chain fatty acid, a 22-carbon fatty acid called erucic acid, which makes it non-edible. And so it's out of the food chain. It perfectly fits in the Southeast cropping scenario. We grow a lot of cotton, a lot of peanut, and a lot of corn, and to a slight lower extent, soybeans. And it seems to fit in perfectly well in the winter, where the trend is to fallow cropland. Like I said, it's moderately cold and heat and drought tolerant, and high level of protein, about 44% and 40% of oil. If I look, again, I don't mean to, a lot of people sitting in this room could be growing one of these other oil seeds, but from a southeastern perspective, from a Florida, Georgia, Alabama perspective, we have found, and we've worked with all three species. We worked with canola and camelina as well. And I know canola and camelina are still there are hybrid canola and other commercial varieties of camelina that are still very popular in other parts of the U.S. But from a southern, southeastern perspective, we see carinata stand out as compared to all these other oil seeds in terms of just normal oil yield and seed yield, and the biomass. What really talks to sustainability issues is the biomass that is returned to the soil per hectare, and the total number of carbon dioxide equivalents that are captured both in biomass and fuel production per hectare of cultivation. In addition to the, look very good, but anyway, ecosystem services, I don't know what I was thinking using the color. In the southeast, especially in the Florida Panhandle region, we have at least two or three springs that are loaded with nutrients. We have the Jackson Blue Springs and the Suwannee Valley Springs, that the nutrient overload that's coming from the from fallowed land, the excess nitrogen that's going into those springs is unbelievable. We're sitting on sands, by the way. If we have 0.5% organic matter, that's pretty much what we have. If we hit 2% organic matter, we are the best in the region. Not true for a lot of other folks in other parts of the world. 2% is bad for you. But we're literally sitting on beach sand, and the amount of nitrogen that goes into growing that cotton and corn and peanuts, all that ends up in the water. And so here we have a winter crop that reduces that leaching potential, in addition to controlling all the pests and the diseases. And the win-win here is it's a cash crop in the winter. It's not like oats or other cover crop that, it builds soil for sure, but it doesn't have any revenue for the farmer. So here's a cash crop potential for the farmer. Just simple math. If I fertilize Brassica carinata at about 90 kilograms per hectare, and in under ideal condition harvest about 3,300, fresh seed is 23% protein. Protein is typically 16% nitrogen. If I do the math, I'm actually extracting some of the nitrogen in the seed. And remember, I'm returning all the remaining residues back in the soil. So just a little math to illustrate the ecosystem services potential that it could have in the southeast. Ideally, our goal is to produce about 3,500 pounds seed per acre, which roughly correlates to about 210 gallons of oil per acre. We want to plant it in November. These are ideal condition, and harvest early May so that our following summer crops can be planted without a problem and without an yield penalty. Here's the situation. When I say a lower range, if you have an yield goal of whatever, on the lower range, the farmer can spend anywhere about $500 to a hectare, and the upper range is about $800, which is about $200 to $350 to an acre. And if you look, the biggest cost of production is in the fertilizer. About half of his production costs are in fertilizer. So I'm not going to lie. This is not a low-input crop. It doesn't need water. You put it, you plant it, it does not need water. Maybe except, so it doesn't need irrigation at all. So zero water use, but it needs nitrogen. So it is not, you cannot put it on some marginal land and expect it to grow. However, you give it the nitrogen that it needs, which a farmer in the southeast is used to doing. We are growing crop on sands. We're not asking him to do anything extra, really. It's normal. But really working on that fertilizer cost and helping him reduce that cost is one of our goals as we move forward. I'm going to move forward. What it means for the Florida farmer and the Southeast U.S. in general is just in Florida, we have about 200,000 acres available for cultivation. And that's a conservative estimate. In seasonal perennial grasses that go dormant, it can be overseeded onto that dormant grass or just fallowed row crop land. Realistically speaking, we'll never have 100% participation. But even if the most progressive 15 to 18% farmers participate in it, we have about 40 to 100 million gallons of biofuel per year, which translates to about $150 to $320 per acre, which may or may not seem too large. But here was some fallowed winter land sitting, doing nothing but growing weeds and pests and eroding land and nutrients being leached. Here's what I'm telling the farmer. Something that was producing nothing in the winter, here you're making about $300 per acre. Makes sense, but it's not that easy. And then extrapolate it to the 12 million acres of potential southeast fallowed land in the winter and look at what it could do to the biofuel economy. Like I said, removing constraints and developing. First, we cannot look at the biofuel system. We cannot look at individual components only. We have to look at the supply chain as a whole. Look at the footprint left behind by the whole supply chain. Because the trickle-down, it matters how it moves downstream of harvesting or downstream of the supply chain has a feedback effect on what it means to the farmer. And so our focus has been to remove those constraints by doing advanced yield trials in multiple locations in the Southeast, specifically looking at stress tolerant. We don't get too cold, but when we do get cold, we go down a few times when we go down to the teens, it's really bad. It can have a very adverse impact on the crop. We're looking for high yielding, of course, because the farmer gets paid on seed yield, really not on oil yield, obviously. It's on seed yield. We're looking at early maturity. We need early maturing ones. We need the crop to come out of the ground fast so that our cotton is not affected, our peanut is not affected. We want to find that perfect fit, that perfect window where our winter is completely utilized, but it's not at the cost of our following crop. We need a winter crop alternative. We do a lot of oats and rye, but they don't generate much revenue. People do a lot of wheat, but not so much. So people are looking for winter crop alternatives. We're looking at crop establishment, planting date, tillage density, nutrient management, that very important factor, increasing nutrient use efficiency. Pest management, again, it's very disease resistant. Disease is not a problem very much, but it's Florida. And you have to be careful that in Florida, every season there's a new disease. So we never take that lightly. Harvest management, if we can use drying down products early on to get that crop out earlier so that the farmer can go back with his peanut or cotton. We're doing herbicide tolerance screening. This is not an established commodity as yet, so there are no labeled products in the market. And exploring various crop rotation scenarios for the southeastern farmer. This is just some examples of how freeze damage can really affect some of the germplasms. Every year we do several advanced germplasm evaluations, and freeze damage is one very important thing. And actually good selections, good lines have come out of our trials at Quincy, Florida, but then we've had mild winters after that, so then, you know, we've not been able to do very much after that. I just want to show you some pictures of the crop. When it comes up, it looks like, you know, it looks like a moderate stand, but the crop has immense capacity to compensate. And so even if you put, you know, about 3 to 4 pounds per acre seeding density, it has immense capacity to just branch and make a canopy and compensate for it. And so if you look at the dried down crop, virtually all the seeds fall off and all you have is pods. That's winter stiger. Some of you probably have seen it in the exhibits. We have a really swanky machine there. But anybody who is a small grain farmer in the Southeast would have a small grain combine and really doesn't need to buy anything new to harvest this crop. So small grain combine and planting equipment, infrastructure is all there. We've looked at some crop rotation studies. We've tried to follow the Carinata with peanut and cotton and soybean. And really, the ones with following Carinata have a little edge, but I'm not going to really dwell on that too much. But the take-home message is that Carinata does not have an adverse effect on the following crop. And that's what we want to see. If it has a yield boost on the following crop, well, then it's even better. But those things we have not established yet. It definitely doesn't have an adverse effect. Some of the commercial activities that have been going on, like I said, we work with AgriSoma. That holds the largest germplasm. Those yellow and red dots show their presence in the U.S., a lot of concentrated effort in the Southeast and then in the Northern Great Plains, in the Dakotas, some in the Minnesota area. In the Southeast, we have about 19 growers who had signed up for commercial production this past year, about 3,800 acres in total. But I must say that the commercial production was quite disappointing, just because all those 3,800 acres are sitting on a variety of soil types. We are ranging from sandy loam to deep, deep sands. And so how you manage this crop in such variable soil is something that we still need to understand. Timing of nitrogen application, how much to apply, when to apply, planting density and things like that. I also want to mention that AgroSoma has its presence in South America, and so they're trying to look at different geographies to have a year-round supply. So when we grow it in the fall and winter, Uruguay is growing it in the summer, and you know, it just is a year-round supply. It's a mature fuel already in use. Applied Research Associates has already tested the Carinata fuel in several of their test flights. I will not go into this. It's a catalytic hydrothermolysis process that they use. And our biggest recipient has been the U.S. Navy so far. Other recipients in Lufthansa and Air Force, Lufthansa in Europe, of course. The biggest pull has been all the commercial production that has happened so far in the Southeast has gone to Europe for European aviation companies. The biofuel supply chain cannot be competitive unless every aspect of the fuel is fuel and the byproducts is utilized. And really, the byproduct utilization is as important as fuel utilization. As an example, we have a big deficit of crude protein need and total digestible nutrient need in the winter in Florida. Our cattle are grown in Florida and then they are finished somewhere in Denver, Colorado, because we just don't have enough protein sources in Florida. And that's another opportunity for Carinata seed meal to come in. So we did some experiments, feeding experiments with cattle, and some experiments with poultry are currently underway. Like I mentioned earlier, and I want to finish real quick, we are talking about building a resilient supply chain in the Southeast. We cannot talk about every component individually or in isolation of the other, because each have an impact on the other. So we are talking about, here's Carinata, but it's not going to fulfill all the demands. Definitely not. We are not kidding anybody. But we have other non-food oil seeds that are going wasted. For instance, non-food grade peanut. Farmers are penalized a lot for off-grade peanuts every year. They make no money on off-grade peanut. That could possibly go into the same chain. It can always go into that same conversion pathway because they're all oil seeds. And then looking at advanced renewables for making an enhanced, resilient bioeconomy, really what we are talking about, and not just growing the crop sustainably, but looking at the supply chain as a whole. And I'll just leave that slide over there. I really don't want to use all of my 25 minutes. These are some of the things that we are doing. We call ourselves the Southeast Partnership for Advanced Renewables. We recently put in a CAP grant, and regardless of the outcome of that grant, we continue to do some of these things. With that, thank you, and if there's time for questions, I will. Okay, so we planted 15th of November, and end of May is the earliest that we can take it out. So that's already pushing it. Yes?
Is there a possibility of this becoming a winter weed in other fallow fields around it with seed growth? You know, mustard's a big problem already.
Yeah, oh my goodness, wild mustard, yes. Kitty, you know that. But one of the first things that we had to demonstrate was that it was not it wouldn't become an invasive species when we went, you know, when AgroSoma went to the EPA for, you know, getting all its regulations and things like that. So we already demonstrated that it wouldn't become an invasive species in the Southeast. So that was one of the first things that we had to demonstrate. So AgroSoma was well ahead in that. Yes. 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 So once the oil has been extracted and that it has been broken. So C22-1 is the, so it has 1 degree of unsaturation. That's the fatty acid that makes it non-edible. But once the oil has been extracted, hexane extracted, all the anti-nutrient, most of it. There's one thing that I did not talk about is the glucosinolate part, but that's the only anti-nutrient that could potentially remain. So it is after the oil has been hexane extracted, it really doesn't matter. The meal is not, is perfectly edible for the animal. Yes. What do they cause? Yes, glucosinolates have a negative impact on their iodine absorption, and so it leads to thyroid and those kind of abnormalities in cattle and other. So high glucs are really a no-no. Mm-hmm. Thank you.